Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life. It's a weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and I'm joined this morning by Graham Anthony, who is our new fill-in co-host for Tim Henney while he's on hiatus. Graham Anthony, along with Dave Cushing, will alternate and join me on The Mountain Life. Nice to have you, Graham. Good morning.
Good morning, Lynn. Good morning, Park City and KPCW listeners everywhere. Glad to be here. For my first day on the show, we will talk about fulfillment, one of my favorite topics, and life's purpose. Maybe it's my life's purpose to be a radio host. I don't know. We'll find out. So we will talk about it. Our first guest, Dr. Anna Usum, is board-certified psychiatrist who studied at Stanford, Yale, and NYU. She blends science and research with an approach to self-actuality and spirituality. Her new book is called Fulfilled: How the Science of Spirituality Can Help You Live a Happier, More Meaningful Life.
And that sounds like a great segue into our next topic. Why not follow that up with talking about wine? Marissa Ross is a columnist for Bon Appetit magazine, and she's written a book called Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. She's fun, and she's funny, and she knows, oh, and she loves her wine.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. This summer, Park City Mountain offers a variety of events for the whole family, including the annual July 4th celebration and fireworks, summer concert series, and weekly Wednesday Farmers Market. The full calendar of Park City Mountain events is available at parkcitymountain.com.
Support of KPCW comes from Zions Bank International Banking and Foreign Exchange Services. Zions Bank, we haven't forgotten who keeps us in business. More information available online at zionsbank.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, Graham Anthony. Well, are you living the life you always thought you wanted, but feel that something is still missing? Do you think you should be happier than you are, considering all that you have? Have you achieved your professional or personal goals, but still feel racked with insecurities, anxiety, or depression, and can't figure out why? Well, our first guest is Dr. Anna Usum. She's a board-certified psychiatrist. She studied at Stanford, Yale, and NYU, but then she went on to study Kabbalah, to learn Buddhist meditation, and train under South American shamans and Indian gurus, perhaps looking for that something more. She joins us now to talk about her new book called Fulfilled: How the Science of Spirituality Can Help You Live a Happier, More Meaningful Life. Dr. Anna Usum, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, your story in and of itself is interesting enough for me to talk about for the time we have. But, you know, I'm always so interested in people who have the best education money can buy. And you go through life, you know, in the early years of being a doctor, and you get to this point that you make this huge shift that either there's something more in your life personally or something more professionally that you need to turn to. Tell us about that transformation for you.
Absolutely, Lynn. And so that's exactly what happened to me, because I had all these healing tools under my belt. I, you know, had gone, like you said, to the top schools that money could buy and worked hard and achieved things. And somehow, despite all that, I found myself somehow unfulfilled and feeling like something was missing. And I looked towards all my healing tools to try to fill that void. But somehow it just didn't work for me. And then I was like, well, I need to figure out how to heal people after all, or I need to figure out how to heal myself, because after all, I have to heal other people. You know, how can I heal others if I can't heal myself? And that's what got me on this journey. And it was through the spiritual journey that I discovered a set of principles that I present in my book that, you know, I felt for me filled the void and that I'd been using for the last 10 years with my patients.
So start us off with, you know, what's the first tool that you used that you found was really effective to kind of fill that void?
The first tool was authenticity, and that's reclaiming your life and connecting to the deepest part of who you really are. You know, so many of us define ourselves in terms of labels, in terms of expectations of others, but very few could actually look inside and ask the question, what do I most deeply want? Who am I underneath all those labels and all the expectations of others? And it's only in doing that that we can start to align and start living more truer, authentic lives.
Dr. Yusum, this is Graham, and I'm curious if after all those years required, I think in the book you describe you almost woke up one day and were a psychiatrist, and I know how long that actually takes. But you, having accomplished all of that as an MD, as a psychiatrist, in your own therapy, what in your background, and I understand you have an interesting family background, brought you to have to want more to feel even more accomplished, or was it to simplify what you'd already learned?
I think, you know, it's such a great question. It seemed like I had everything that I should have, and at the time I was in a relationship with a good man, and I had a good career, and things were good, so why didn't I feel fulfilled? Like, I somehow still felt a void within myself, and I think it was because I was living kind of this life that I was supposed to live. Like, I hadn't yet fully owned my life yet. I hadn't fully started living authentically and connecting to the deepest part of who I was. And somehow, even with all these external accoutrements of success and the life that you were supposed to have, something felt off. I still felt empty inside. And that's what I find with so many of my patients who come in having everything that they should have, yet feeling this inner emptiness. And I realize only over time that the root of that was spiritual neglect.
And so do you think there's an element of following the path of least resistance that's prescribed for you?
Yes. I was kind of following the path of least resistance. And it's interesting. It wasn't the least resistance of, like, sitting on my couch watching TV. It was the least resistance of kind of continuing with the rat race that I started running and never really looking outside it. That was a path of least resistance, even though it was a very difficult path involving a lot of hard work. But that path doesn't really, you know, necessitate or encourage soul searching. It doesn't necessitate you to swerve off the path if the path isn't exactly for you. And I don't want to say that by any means I've discounted my training as a doctor or as a psychiatrist. I very much integrate that into my work with patients, but then I supplement it with what I felt I wasn't able to fully get from the psychiatric profession and through my psychological studies, and I add a little bit of spirituality into my work with patients.
Yeah, so great. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Anna Yusum. She's the author of a new book called Fulfilled, How the Science of Spirituality Can Help You Live a Happier, More Meaningful Life. And it's funny, as I just read that tagline, it strikes me that the science of spirituality, you know, the science of your background, psychiatry, is kind of about the science, in large part, of medication. So how does leading your patients towards being aware of the spiritual neglect conflict with your writing of prescriptions?
And that's such a good question. Like, where do medications fall into all this, right? And so in my practice, I certainly have patients on medication. Probably about half of my patients take some sort of medication, and this is for anxiety, for depression, for bipolar. The only time that I say to a patient, you really need to be on medication, is when the symptoms are pretty severe, meaning that they have uncontrolled schizophrenia, that right. They have, you know, an acute manic episode in bipolar, or when they're feeling suicidal with depression, perhaps, you know, some sort of heroin withdrawal or something that they're getting over an addiction. Those are the cases where, you know, medications usually are indicated from a medical standpoint. But in other cases, patients have a reasonable choice. And I find more and more people are coming to me knowing I'm a psychiatrist and can prescribe, but they don't want medication. They want to get off their medication. They're tired of medication. They want to look for other alternatives. And that's when, in addition to more traditional talk therapy of my profession, I also offer them some of the spiritual tools that, you know, I have connected to over these years.
Okay, so authenticity, the first tool that you use personally, and that seems like such a great one to me, because you can think about your authentic self and it really ought not take up a lot of time. You can go through your day and think about it. And the reason I say that is because I think that, you know, it's almost this badge of honor to be busy in our lives. And a lot of people would say, well, I don't really have time to pursue, you know, meditation and all the things that you pursued. And so when you start with authenticity, it's like, I don't know, give us a few clues about how to do that just as we go through our day, our very busy, busy day.
Right. Precisely. And I was the epitome of exactly what you're describing. I was so busy, I didn't have really a chance to check in with myself. And I kept filling up my days with more and more things. But what that did was it alienated me from myself rather than reconnecting me to myself. It's very interesting how, you know, we can sometimes be so busy and be workaholics, and that's a form almost of externalizing our power and putting it on somewhere else, almost to escape from our own selves. So the first part of authenticity really is just reconnecting and just checking in with yourself now and then, asking, how am I feeling right now? You know, how am I really feeling right now? What is it that I most deeply want? And really just starting to have a more of an inner dialogue and connecting to your own inner voice. It's such a simple and little thing, but something that so few of us really do.
How do you address that terms of individual authenticity with, you frequently refer to, you seem very open to the notion of a higher power in whatever form we choose, whether it be God or nature or some other form. And but you cite some very specific data on people who practice traditional religion in the book. And it's the well-being generally, the health outcomes, the recovery outcomes for people who are involved in traditional religious were stunning to me.
It's truly amazing, yes. And this is the thing, like, no one really knows the exact mechanism, though many mechanisms have been purported, but it has been shown that having a spiritual practice actually helps people recover from numerous medical as well as physical and mental and emotional problems. And it's been this has been shown in study after study. So it's almost like the science is starting to validate what so many traditions and so many people have known to be true for a really long time. Right.
Well, I've seen that appear in a pattern, I think, throughout history, is we developed rituals as a society. For these reasons, they have a purpose in our lives. And do you think that's what we get out of religion, that we are seem to be losing in our social settings?
Oh, certainly. So in terms of the mechanism, you know, how does religion or spirituality help to heal people? Certainly having certain practices or rituals that help to structure one's life, that's one of them. And other ways are through being part of a supportive community, having life-affirming beliefs about what it means to live a good life, you know, practicing things like forgiveness and opening one's heart to love, which are often spiritual religious ideals that really aren't taught in school. And then, you know, there's other things, you know, if there is a higher power out there, if people believe in that, you can tap into that. You can, in a way, surrender and get some guidance in your own life by being able to tap into that, that power, feeling also that you're not alone. You don't have to be in all of this alone in your life and in this world. So those are just a few of the mechanisms.
You talk about filling your heart with love, and you have this great chapter on releasing addictions. And oddly enough, I mean, of course, you talk about, you know, the usual addictions, but you talk about this woman, Marcella, who's was not addicted to drugs. She was addicted to rage, which I find so interesting, because we all, you know, we don't think about people's addiction to rage, yet we just think that that's a behavior, and we see it exhibited among, you know, people we come in contact with. But could you talk about that?
Certainly, yes. So Most people think of addictions in the traditional sense, that we're addicted to substances, drugs, alcohol, perhaps to behaviors, gambling, there's such a thing as sex addiction. But then there's this whole other area of addiction that's often overlooked, and that's psychological addictions. That's addictions to, for instance, status, to power, to fame, to money, to rage. And so I define an addiction as anything we use to fill a void. And where the more of it that we get, the emptier we actually feel. And so in a way, people use anger in that way often. Like my patient, Marcella, obviously it's a, you know, disguised, you know, case. But she is someone who would just explode all the time. And whenever anything was going, was off in her life, she would use her anger as a way almost of diffusing her own anxiety about the situation. Any emotion she felt, she escaped from through her anger. And when there really wasn't anything to be angry about for a while, she would start looking for provocations and things. It was kind of like anger was her heroin. She just would use it. When she didn't have it, she would withdraw from it. After she exploded, she would feel great for a second, like this momentary sense of power, but then she'd feel really empty inside. And in this way, you know, we help to recognize almost the addictive quality of this anger and slowly give her tools to overcome and release that.
And so do you believe there's an organic a purpose or reason for that?
Yes. Like, you mean, is there a biological underpinning as to what leads certain people to, you know, to do that? You know, like the root cause of addiction, you know, it's the dopamine pathway. You know, more the substances that make us feel good, they release dopamine from certain areas of the brain. And for behaviors, it's been shown that it's a very, very similar mechanism that's used. Similar regions of the brain light up on, you know, the MRIs when you have somebody who is undergoing, you know, getting a pleasurable stimulus through a behavior as they would through a drug. And in a way, an explosive anger behavior is just like that.
And so that leads us to someone I think we all know here locally in Park City, not the individual, but the type. And that is the, I believe his name's Daryl, who was addicted to... to adrenaline at its core.
Yes, adrenaline junkie, that's right.
And but he also was someone we know around here who likes to cheat death as part of that. And can you talk a little about his case?
Absolutely. So it's a very, very interesting case on the people who are addicted to adrenaline. Because adrenaline is like any other addiction when you think about it. You feel a little empty inside, and then you seek out death-defying stunts or things that give you that rush in order to, you know, get your high. And then afterwards, you feel empty inside, you start to withdraw, then you need another high. And it's interesting because I talk about that case, not in my addiction chapter, but actually in my chapter on overcoming fear. And a very common fear we as human beings have is a fear of death. Like at the root of it, it's a basic existential fear because all of us one day will succumb to it. But some people, to defy their fear of death, they take part in these death-defying feats. It's called a counterphobia. They go against their fear in an effort to overcome their fear. They do everything to defy death, to actually deal with their fear of death. So it's very, very interesting. There's a lot of Daryls in this world.
Wow, Daryl. That's very interesting, a fear of death. Well, how do you figure out if you're one of those people? I mean, I would say that, you know, I have a natural fear of death. But how do you know if you're sort of overcome or overly preoccupied by it?
Right. You know, the people who truly have death anxiety, they come in and it is one of the foremost issues on their mind. Like, they just fear it. It takes up a disproportionate amount of time and space in their mind and in their life. Like, it really is something that is in many ways incapacitating. That being said, worries about death and thoughts about death are so human and so normal because, you know, like I said, it's something that we all have to face with. And not only that, but it's something that we're all encountering all the time. People are dying around us all the time. Our loved ones, people on TV, et cetera. You really can't go by a day without encountering ideas of death in some form. So really, I think it's about whether it causes any kind of incapacitation in your life. And that's what could make it problematic and would lead you to, you know, seek help for it.
Right. So, you know, I can't call to mind right now any studies or stories, but we've all read them and we've all heard tell of, you know, for example, children in third world countries that are playing with some piece of rubbish that they found in the dump, and they seem so happy and so content. And the same goes for adults oftentimes in, you know, developing countries, that while they have the stressors of, you know, finding clean water and you know, real third world problems, right? We find that in a first world setting, especially like an affluent town like Park City, we see that all the money in the world and all the success in terms of, you know, money, I suppose, will not necessarily buy you happiness. And I mean, this is the crux of your book, but talk a little bit about that sort of, you know, on the spectrum of culture and how it relates to socioeconomic well-being.
Absolutely.
When will I know that I'm happy?
Yeah, right. And, you know, to your point, it's been shown that, you know, when you look at the correlation between socioeconomic status and happiness, up until a certain point, there is a positive correlation. And that's up until the point of where your survival needs are met. Certainly, people who are in poverty, it's been shown, have more stress and are less fulfilled and happy than people who are out of poverty. But up, you know, beyond that, when your survival needs are being met, more money does not equal more happiness. And quite the contrary, money can create a lot of problems. Like I have in my practice, a lot of people, for instance, with trust funds. And what trust funds can do, they can incapacitate people and take away for a little bit one's own motivation to, you know, be successful and to create the life they want, because they've never had that hunger. They've never had to hone in on the need to survive. It's always just been handed to them. And if there's a lot of people with this issue, so actually sometimes having too much can undermine one's capacity for fulfillment and one's motivation. But, you know, across the world, you're exactly right. Money and happiness doesn't correlate, and that's been shown over and over.
I think anyone who has traveled in third world countries has witnessed this and felt like they it was confusing at first to see families and children who appear to have nothing by our standards are so happy. And it also, if you spend enough time with it, becomes clear that they have each other and they have community and they have family and generational love that we frequently dismiss as we follow our pursuits to success.
Precisely, precisely. And, you know, there's a very natural human tendency for self-comparison. And here in our culture, we can look around and there's always someone who's going to have more in certain ways. And I guess that's the case in most cultures, but people from different cultures, they'll look around and they're not going to be comparing their lives to our lives. They're going to be comparing their lives to the lives of the people around them. And there isn't as much of the need to run the rat race to up, you know, one-up each other. It's a much more collaborative, oftentimes, society than some of the more competitive countries. So indeed, there's more family cohesion and a lot of the social support that leads to happiness and fulfillment in people's lives.
So just take me, well, I'll read this. I am, this is what the Dalai Lama says. I am open to the guidance of synchronicity and do not let expectations hinder my path. You have a whole chapter on synchronicity. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so synchronicity is the idea of a meaningful coincidence, or it's when something happens in our lives, and in an effort to make sense of it, we imbue it with meaning. And for a lot of people, that imbuing it with meaning is, in a way, indicative of a higher order, like a higher complexity, or the existence of something that kind of has our back and is helping us along. That it's not just random, it's not a coincidence, it's actually evidence of God or the universe, you know, leading us along our path. And I've had in my own life, in my work with patients, so many interesting synchronicities that I then define, you know, in the book and describe, that has really just opened me and my patients up to really interesting things.
So can you tie that into a quick discussion of your experience with shamans and telepathic dreams?
Yes. So with synchronicity, I can certainly tell you, the opening case of the book actually is I was 5,000 miles away at a time. I was on a trip to the Ukraine, and one of my patients, so I suddenly woke up in the middle of the night, and I didn't even know what was going on, and I was feeling so anxious. I was felt like I was having a midnight panic attack. I'd never, ever felt like that before. And waking up in the middle of the night, I felt compelled to check my email. And I was just stunned because 2 minutes prior, one of my patients had emailed me that he was feeling suicidal. Somehow or another, I had felt this, and I was compelled to wake up. And because I did, I was able to call my patient and kind of walk him through what he was feeling. But what if I hadn't woken up? And what caused me to wake up? And in a way, like this was, you know, I was woken up from a dream, but it was this knowing of something that I had no way of knowing. And it's, you know, interesting with this patient has had many dreams of things that happened in my life that he had no way of knowing. And then he would come in and tell me this in the session, and I would just be blown away. I was like, and I wouldn't always mention to him that I knew, you know, that, or that, you know, wouldn't always let him know, but that what he dreamed about actually happened. But it just blew me away how connected this person was to my inner world without having any insight into it.
Do you charge for telepathic calls?
Oh, they get a free session, of course.
Excellent. This is a wonderful book. Dr. Anna Yuseem is our guest. The book is called Fulfilled, How the Science and Spirituality Can Help You Live a Happier, More Meaningful Life. And I'm going to start paying more attention to those synchronicities. I think I've lost that. That's part of my problem. What do you think?
I think you've got it going, Lynn.
Thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be right back after these words. We're going to move from spiritual fulfillment into the fulfillment that we perhaps receive from drinking wine. I don't
Confidently.
Know. Confidently. Confidently, that's right. When we return, stay with us.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Experience the ride of a lifetime on the Summer Comet bobsled. Cruise down the full length of the Olympic track used during the 2002 Olympic Winter Games. Driven by a professional pilot, participants will experience 15 turns and reach speeds up to 65 miles per hour. It's truly a ride unlike any other. Details at utaholympiclegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Graham Anthony. We were just speaking with Dr. Anna Yuseem, her book, Fulfilled. And now, well, you know, The Mountain Life is a show in part about lifestyle, and from time to time we include in the conversation the topic of wine. We've found someone who can help us take our wine conversation up a notch while demystifying it at the same time. Marissa Ross does just that at Bon Appetit magazine. She is the magazine's official wine columnist. Marissa is also the author of the award-winning blog called Wine All the Time. That's also the title of her new book, which she calls The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. Is your go-to strategy picking out the bottle with the coolest label? Do you choose your wine pairing based on the cash in your wallet instead of your palate? Marissa joins us to help you step it up. Welcome, Marissa, to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It's really, I'm really looking forward to having you here. Your book is, it sucked us both in, but I'll tell you where it sucked me in. It's about the time that you have two Craigslist roommates. One is an addict and a hoarder, maybe even a hooker. The other one's a drug dealer. So you're poor, but you hide in your closet, essentially, which is also your room. And with your $3 wines. And that's kind of where it all began. You thought, well, if I like $3 wines, I probably would love $5 wines.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a really crazy time. I first moved to Los Angeles to pursue comedy writing, and I was straight from the suburbs, had no idea what I was getting into moving in with two people from Craigslist. Obviously, it was a disaster. It kind of spawned I started drinking wine and writing in my room, and I just realized I really loved wine, and it all just kept snowballing until here where we are, and now it's all I do, and it's awesome. I love wine. It's a beautiful thing.
It is. Well, I have to just read this one description of your wine, and that this is actually where I got sucked into your book. Franzia White Zinfandel smells like moldy oranges covered in corn syrup and tastes like a melted pack of knockoff Sour Patch Kids that you found between the car seats. That is brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, luckily Franzia gave me a lot of inspiration there.
Where can I get some?
Yeah, luckily you can get it everywhere. It's crazy. Franzia.
Even in
everywhere.
Utah. Yeah.
Well, there's actually some really cool wine coming out of Salt Lake now. Some really cool natural winemakers.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Yeah.
All 50 states, is that not true?
Yeah, it's happening, man. Wine culture in America, we may be young compared to the rest of the world, but we're really stepping up our game in the last probably 5 to 10 years. It's a really exciting time. A wine consumer in America.
It is, and we've come a long way from the California versus the world era of wine, and it's, I think, the era of the mega producers has settled down, and the new age of micro producers is enhancing the experience.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think it's great. I'm personally a big fan of natural wines, and those are, very small producers that are making, limited quantities. But the character of the wines are much more unique and special. And I think that they're, at least for me, a lot more fun to drink and write about. And they are what inspire me regularly.
Well, if I went out to the wine store here and wanted to buy any of the labels that are presented on the cover of your book, I'm not sure I'd find a one.
You might find some. I know. Well, Utah's pretty notoriously hard on alcohol, so I haven't bought alcohol there personally, but it might be kind of hard to find them. But the good news is, or at least I think the good news is, that even though consumers can't always find the exact bottle that I'm recommending, I think it's important for, them to still go try and look for it, because it will still lead them to trying something new. Maybe they'll be recommended something that's like what I drank, or, they can at least learn about new wines that way, even if it's not the exact one, which I think is the most quintessential thing in learning about wine, is just always trying new things.
Our guest is Marissa Ross. She is an award-winning blogger of the blog Wine All the Time. She writes the wine column in Bon Appetit magazine, and she's written a new book, also called Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. So I know that when I ask you this question, you'll say, Lynn, no, it's not really wrong that you do this, but you might be more enlightened if you did this other thing. So what I do, and again, Utah is, we're pretty limited in our state owned and run liquor stores, but I go in, I look for what's on sale and what matched with what has the highest rating with Wine Spectator.
Oh, wow.
So what's your answer to that? How can I step it up?
I'm sort of anti the point system.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm not a big fan of the point system, because I just feel like that sometimes this is, and I know that I get a lot of flack for this because I don't write negative reviews on my site. And people are like, well, you're not really a wine reviewer because you don't give negative reviews. But my thought on that is, like, well, I don't want to say something, like, wine is so subjective. that I don't think it's fair to rate something low just because I don't like it when it could be something that you really love. So if that's a way that's working for you, though, if like you love those wines that are like the 95-point wines and that works for you, then that's great. I personally think that, like I said, I always just want to try something new. And I like to go into wine shops and I ask, what's new? Like, what's weird? What's crazy? Like, show me something that I've never had before, and then trying that. Or being like, hey, I really feel like I'm in the mood for a warm, fuzzy red or a really, really bright, acidic white wine, and letting the professional at the wine shop kind of point me in the right direction.
Oh, great idea. So I've noticed recently, well, wine is very trendy. It really is. And we were just talking about the movie Sideways before we came on air and talking about how that destroyed Merlot and boosted Pinot Noir sales and how funny and ridiculous that was. I also noticed that there's this surge of red blends recently.
Yeah.
Big time. Maybe it's just a Utah thing. I don't know. Or maybe we're actually behind the trend about 5 years. Talk about red blends and then where you go from there when you find that they actually are too big in the berries.
Yeah. So red blends, I mean, those have been around forever. Whether you're talking about France or California, I think they're like newer to America than probably the rest of the world in terms of like making them here. I personally think a great red blend is awesome. But if you're finding that they're a little bit too big for you, I think a better thing to do is, one, you do have to like talk to people. That's like the whole thing about wine that I think people are mostly scared of is just like talking about it and like asking. If you're finding that the red blends are too bold, like too heavy, a little bit too jammy for you, I suggest doing something from a cooler climate. So when you're getting the big jammy wines, they're usually from warm climates where the grapes ripen, longer and they create more sugar because it's hotter. And subsequently, they're very like big and jammy and that whole thing. So if you go somewhere if you buy a wine from a cooler climate, like let's say California versus Oregon, like Pinot Noir as an example, the California Pinot Noir might be bigger because it's hotter in California, and then the Oregon, because it's a colder climate, it'll have higher levels of acidity, and it'll be a lighter, tartar wine than what you are having from the warmer climate.
I figured out years ago that if I was stumped on a label or even sometimes a varietal, if I could come up with the origin of the wine, I'd usually be very successful.
Totally. And that's a big part of the book, too, is like helping people understand regions and learning that how to kind of figure out what regions you like and using those as ways to also explore more wine and more different varietals, too. Because if you like how maybe one red from the Loire Valley is, there's a good chance that you'll like another red from the Loire Valley because they have similar characteristics.
Yeah, I have to say, I enjoyed your book immensely, and I've seen more than a few. Disclosure, I used to be in the wine events business in Atlanta, and I watched it go from, I'm talking back in 2000 when wine events were pretty much a new thing, at least in that area.
Yeah.
And I think the best thing you do in here, from my perspective, is what I call the shuffle playlist effect. When you have that moment when you're listening to music on shuffle and it just presents a song that makes the moment, that perfectly addresses it. And the way you link music and wine in that form so that when you taste something you've never had before and it just defines the moment for you is what's so much fun.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for the kind words. I compare wine to music a lot. I wrote about music for a little while as a hobby before I wrote about wine. And so to me, they're very, very similar. And I love that analogy because you just sometimes never know like what's going to make that meal, make that evening, in trying these new things or, you know, just being open, you know, to that song or that wine can really make a huge difference in, you know, your enjoyment of the evening and quite possibly your life. Like there's some wines that I've had that have really changed my life. And I know that sounds kind of crazy, but I wouldn't be writing about it, you know, otherwise. I think that there's just certain wines that are magic for people.
So you put yourself out there in a very public way with your column and your blog and now your book. And I'm sure that you get some naysayers because you have a new sort of approach to talking about or to being a wine connoisseur, really. So what are some of those things? I mean, I just have to say that a lot of the photos of you, and you're so adorable, by the way, have you slugging out of the mouth of a bottle of wine.
Yeah, so that, I mean, and that kind of started as, like, because I was a comedy writer, and I had, like, in the beginning, I had this, like, comedy web series called Wine Time, where I drank, where I reviewed $2 to $10 bottles of wine from the grocery store. And the end joke was like, sometimes you need to, you know, sometimes you have a great day and you need to know if you need to slug a bottle of wine out of the bottle, or sometimes you have a bad day, or sometimes you just don't have any glasses because your roommate that's a hoarder took them all. You need to know these things. So that's how that started. And then it just sort of became a thing. Of course I have some naysayers. Of course I have critics, and that's okay. I'm fine with that. You know, for me, I believe that everyone that's in the wine industry can bring something to it. And, you know, if I guess I mostly get a lot of criticism from sommeliers and people like that. But I sort of think of it as, if I'm getting the person that normally drinks a vodka soda at dinner to order a glass of wine at a restaurant, then I'm helping, you know, like then the job is done. Like, that person is now a part of our community. And even if you don't like the way that I'm presenting information, or if you don't like me, that's fine, because we're still helping people enjoy wine, and that should always be the focus. So I try to ignore when people criticize me too much and try to focus on the positive stuff.
Right. So you have this one sidebar, and I didn't read all the way through it, but the tagline is "How to Cure Yourself of Accidental Snobbery." And I would like for you to address those people that don't really know what they're talking about, but they talk about, "Oh, this is so chewy," or "Look at those legs there," you know. And it's not that I don't actually know that they don't know what they're talking about, but I don't know, you know, when
yeah,
how to save ourselves from being that.
Well, you know, it's something. I think that what that comes from is just wine culture has just changed a lot. And I talk about wine culture as sort of being on this pendulum, and the pendulum always swings for wine being for the people and wine being for status. And if we think about, you know, wine in the 90s as like peak status with, like, you know, like Opuses and all that California stuff that was happening, and just the big, big bottles and, you know, auctions and things like that. And now the pendulum has swung back, and now we're about to be, you know, 20 years later, wine is coming back to all of us. And I think that the snobbery that a lot of people have is actually just like a backlash from that culture, where they feel like they have to talk about wine that way, that is what you're supposed to do. And you don't have to. And it shouldn't be. Wine is not about being better than anyone else. And that's also where it comes from. It's something people use it like, you know, music snobs or film critics, you know, like film snobs, anything where they feel that it gives them a certain power over other people. When I believe that wine knowledge should be shared freely and open, like fun conversation, and used as a way to bring people together and not isolate one another. And hopefully, you know, as more people start talking about wine in a more casual way, then that will just die out.
Which is more important, a graduate degree in winemaking and viticulture, or a darn good backstory?
I guess I have to say a darn good backstory, considering where I am. But I mean, it could go either way. I think that either way, you just need to have a lot of grit, and that's what's going to take you pretty far. I'm really fortunate. You know, I'm a college dropout, and I just love writing and I love wine, and I'm really fortunate that I have the career that I have. But it's because I really wanted it. And I think if you really want it, just like if you really want a degree, I obviously didn't really want one. You know, whatever you really, really want, you can have it, as long as you work hard.
Marissa, are you fulfilled?
Not quite yet, but almost. I'm working on it. I'm very happy. I really you know, I see this as the beginning of a path for me, and I hope, I really, really want to make a difference in the lives of, like, winemakers, as well as, you know, make an impact for consumers and help educate people on, you know, the effects of wine, not only on your health, but also on the environment, and also, you know, promote small business. And so I want to take this to the next level, and I just see this as the beginning. And I think when I have that opportunity, which is hopefully the next book, I think I'll be pretty fulfilled then.
Well, let's say you're ambitious, at least.
you got to be. Without a college degree and you're just drinking wine, you got to be ambitious.
I think you found a pretty good path there.
So thank you.
I just have to ask you, I think it's in the first, maybe it's even in the intro of the book, you talk first about how you're not a master sommelier, you're not even a sommelier, and then this thing about not having finished college. And I just found it to be very interesting, first of all, because you just get it right out there in front of you. Was there a reason that you did that?
I think that comes from a defense mechanism that I've always just had. I didn't really do it as a defense mechanism in the book, but, you know, for a long time, those were things that defined me in a bad way. And I didn't want those things to define me, you know, like, and I just sort of felt like owning those things always gave me more control over it. And I just wanted to get that out of the way. I want to talk about it first in the book, because that, I think, sets the stage for, like, hey, you don't have to know anything about wine right now, and you can know a lot about wine. Like, if I can do it, you can do it. Like, all you have to do is want it and enjoy it. And so I wanted really to set that stage and let it be known, like, hey, like, we are both consumers of wine. Like, we are both normal people. I'm not some super taster. I'm not in a Somm documentary. I'm not trying to, you know, I want you to learn with me and have a good time with me, and we can all enjoy wine together.
That's crazy talk. Are you going to say that you're going to be authentic?
I know, right? It's crazy. I mean, believe me, my father for most of my life has been like, what are you doing? Like, you can't just, like, say all this stuff. And I'm like, nah, you know what? It's going great. I'm just going to keep saying what I want to say and being honest with people. And just being honest with people. I think that people want that, especially these days. I think there's a lot of there's a lack of transparency across everything in this world, it seems like, these days. And it feels good to be honest with people, and in turn, they're honest with me, and that's a really cool thing.
That is cool. So you've established credibility for yourself, obviously, because Bon Appetit is no slouch of a magazine, and you are the official wine columnist, and then publishing this book with a very good publishing house. And but I want to know, like, what has been the instance in your professional career with wine where you've gotten big, huge kudos from someone that you consider really important to get kudos from?
Yeah, well, I have to say, getting hired at Bon Appetit was probably the biggest kudos I could possibly ever ask for. I was a huge fan of the magazine before I ever met Adam Rappaport, or, you know, I've always been, like, such a fan. And to, like, get, like, a call from Adam Rappaport, who was like, I love your writing, you have to come work for us. Like, you have to work for us, was one of the most crazy things to me, you know, as someone that just, you know, that it's a dream to work for that magazine. So that was really huge. And more recently, Michael Cruz, who's a California winemaker, he got Winemaker of the Year from San Francisco Chronicle last year. And he is making probably the best. He's revolutionizing California sparkling wines. And just this week, he asked for a copy of my book. And I was so nervous to give it to him because, you know, Michael Cruz is like a biochemist, and he's the most just genius dude in California right now, probably, when it comes to wine and, like, the world. And he, like, put my book on his Instagram and was like, this book is so engaging and funny, and I read it all in one day. And the fact that, like, someone that's that amazing, like, genius of a winemaker would read my whole book that's, you know, about, like, the basics of wine and really enjoy it and laugh and support it in that way really, really meant a lot to me.
So I have to ask, have you ever sat in a dark wood-paneled room with a bunch of middle-aged men sitting around a table with a number of Riedel glasses in front of them, and someone pours what you know to be an exclusive and expensive and desirable wine, and you put your nose to the glass and go, ugh.
Oh, yeah. I actually...
Even though it wasn't bad.
Yeah. Even though it wasn't bad? Or
even though it wasn't bad, just to see if you could turn everyone's opinion against it, because nobody wants to go against the grain.
Yeah. Oh, man. No, I haven't done that. I have not done that, no. I try not to, like, just mess with people on purpose. I usually just me being my normal self messes with them enough. So, but I have been in a lot of wood-paneled rooms with lots of middle-aged men who definitely don't like my opinion about the stuff that they're pouring. So being honest is enough to mess with them usually. And it's always, I don't know if I, looking back on those times, I'm like, that was kind of funny, but man, it gets a little stressful.
Well, I'm guessing the square bottom glass you're holding on the cover is a statement as well.
Yeah, well, that actually, a funny story about that glass. Calvin Klein, not the actual person, but they're Calvin Klein glasses, and they sent them to me a couple years ago for a holiday story I was doing for Savoir magazine. This was before I was at Bon Appetit. And they sent me those glasses to use, and I just thought they were so cool and, like, irreverent and just different. And I wanted it to stand out that this was, like, a different book. You know, and I thought that those would be a good statement for that.
Yeah. Well, gosh, unfortunately, we're about out of time, but I really think you should come to Park City. You might have fun during the winter or the summer. You could come during the Sundance Film Festival. Come visit us in the studio. And at that point, we can use the word that I have failed to use, that I always use when we talk to wine people, and that's Brunello. And I know you love Italy too, so we'll talk about that when you come to Park City. How's that sound?
Yeah, we'll have to, and we can actually drink some together. We can do a tasting.
Okay, I would love that. Well, the book is called Wine All the Time. Blogger and columnist for Bon Appetit magazine. It's Marissa Ross, and it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for joining us.
It's been such a pleasure, Lynn and Graham. Thank you guys so much.
Take care. Oh, yes. Wow, and I was on a hiatus from drinking wine for this week.
We're sitting over a liquor store, Lynn.
Yeah.
Let's do some follow-up on this.
Right. Let's be real here. Okay, we'll be right back after these words. It's The Mountain Life.
Support of KPCW comes from Zions Bank Executive Banking Services. Zions Bank, we haven't forgotten who keeps us in business. More information available online at zionsbank.com. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You've been listening to The Mountain Life. Thanks to Graham Anthony, my new fill-in, part-time co-host, filling in for Tim Henney while he's on hiatus and then alternating with Dave Cushing. So thanks for joining today, Graham.
It's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Lynn.
And we want to thank our underwriters, Park Meadows Country Club, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Phil Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, and Zions Bank. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now to drink wine. Oh, no. I mean, it's time now to listen to National Public Radio News from Washington. Thanks for tuning in.